Accession number 30394, reel 5.
So from Huddersfield we were sent down to Tilbury Docks and then round down the English Channel, and like a bloody fool I didn't realise that we were going, you know, actually looking at the White Cliffs of Dover. I must tell you sometime, I kissed Vera Lynn's hand at one stage. Anyway, we went out a long way into the channel with a cruiser keeping an eye on us in case there were still submarines about. And then we turned, went through the Mediterranean, first glimpse of Gibraltar, out to Portside, first smell of the Orient. There is a definite smell of a mixture of latrines and spice and whatever. And then down into the, is it Violet Red? Anyway, into the Indian Ocean and on to Bombay.
Did you have any time ashore in Portside?
No. This was an annoying thing. The other thing was watching Donald Wolfit, who was then a budding Shakespearean actor. He did a couple of sketches on board the troop ship going out, and watching him go ashore at Portside where he was going. Anyway, at Bombay we got off, and wonderful thing, something we hadn't had during a 6-week journey, a mug of tea made with real fresh milk, not condensed. We also had corned beef, or bully beef as we called it, which had been kept cold, and it was quite crisp and firm. And for the first time ever, pickles. Lord. Not chili pickles. Mango chutney. And it really was wonderful. And it was Bombay. And I didn't realise the importance. I don't think we even set eyes on the gateway to India. But we got on a train, went off to a transit camp at Kalyan, and the train was boarded every time it stopped or slowed down with people selling everything from watches to daggers to souvenirs. It was India as it is, and you could offer a slightly smaller price, and it was okay. They would take that. But one thing we learned was never to hand over a 5-rupee note for a 4-rupee purchase, because once you got 5 rupees, you might get the gift, but he would leap off the train. And it was amazing going through several miles of dilapidated buildings and huts and whatever. Incredible.
On the voyage over, apart from the entertainment, how else did you spend the time?
A lot of the time was spent simply, apart from the Bay of Biscay, lying comfortably on your bed and doing nothing. Sometimes you were appointed a sort of sentry on that particular portion of the ship. But most of the time there was nothing to do. But efforts were made, sincere, you know, good efforts made to keep us entertained. Shows, sketches, talks, sing songs, and I can clearly remember one tropical evening up on deck, sitting around, and somebody, an officer, leading us in a sing song. And he ended up by saying, "Well, that's it. Good night, campers." Now, I'd never really heard of a camping holiday, that sort of, you know, what do they call them, butlin sort of things. But he apparently had been a redcoat at one of these places, and he knew how to get the masses of people doing things. Don't ask me what songs we were singing, because I can't remember.
Was there anything in the way of information or briefing about the situation in Burma, or what to expect when you got to India?
Nothing at all. It wasn't until we'd moved out of the transit camp at Kalyan, where incidentally we were warned that the commandant was a pre-war colonel or something, and always exercised on his horse every morning, and that if anybody saw him, they were to salute him. So there's a hangover from the old British Raj. But somewhere on the train going towards the central provinces, a place called Mau, we were given a sort of booklet, which had been compiled by Wavell, and had explained that there were different languages, different religions, different regiments, and what else? Something else. Oh, that he had. If ever we were in Lahore, there was a Wavell club where we could be put up overnight for a nominal sum and fed and that sort of thing. So we go on to Mau, which was the signals, that's Royal Indian Signals and Royal Signals, that was their depot. And there, two things I remember. One is watching a whole crowd of sepoys marching onto the parade ground, very, very smart, and going through a whole series of manoeuvres only to the sound of a drum. Nothing else. No shouting commands. And they were terribly smart. The other thing I remember, absolute loss of appetite, certain amount of diarrhoea, see the medical officer, and he gave me a thorough test. I said, it's not uncommon, lack of appetite. I will contact the mess room and get them to lay on extra appetizing meals and bring them over to you. And as I tell everyone, I'm still waiting for those meals. And then we moved from there. Oh, at that stage I was told that I was to be posted to General Headquarters in Delhi. And I thought, oh, not another, you know, big headquarters, all these punched up fancy officers around. I don't want that. They said, right then, your only other alternative is airborne forces. So, oh, I'll have a go at that. After all, we'd all heard about Arnhem, and, you know, airborne was a good reputation, you know, it was a fancy unit to be in, so I went for airborne forces. So off we go on the Indian trains, and what seems like a ordinary voyage in this country can take 3 or 4 days in India, especially if you're on a troop train, because the troop train is not allowed to interfere with the passenger trains. So sometimes you have to pull in a siding and wait for a passenger train to go by. But but the passenger train may be miles away, and so there you are. And then we get off, and we're in a place called Bilaspur. And it wasn't only until a couple of years ago that I realised it was named after the Beal tribe, who were a really savage Indian tribe. Real trouble, like the Thugs. You've heard of the Thugs. But actually it wasn't that far from the Seonee Mountains where Kipling based most of his Jungle Book. So, you know, with hindsight, it's nice to look back. So there we are, living in tents and bashes. Monsoon is due. Salt tablets every day. Nowadays on television, they say, avoid salt. Mepicrin, you know, just to ward off malaria. And we're under training for what I later found out was Operation Zipper. But in fact, training was a bit slow coaching. You know, there was no great incentive behind it. And we assumed it was to land on Japan, but in fact it was somewhere else, I think. And then suddenly comes VJ Day. Nobody told us anything. We happened to have access to a wireless so we could turn into All India Radio, tune in, and we found the war was over. Week later, things as normal, except that I've got a sore throat. And I hadn't shaved. That's another story, the whiskers. And the officer said, why haven't you shaved? I said, I've got a sore throat, sir. Well, you better go special sick. So I went back to my tent, packed all my stuff to go sick, and I kept clearing my throat. Going, I better have something to show. When I got to the hospital, I don't remember much more. I woke up, and it was a week afterwards, and they were injecting me with anti-diphtheria serum. Would it be a serum? Amazing. I'd been a whole week. I don't know whether I was really delirious, but certainly a temperature so high that they were virtually on the brink of telegraphing my family that I was, you know, going to go. High temperature, but I recovered, and rumour has it that I'm still alive. But it's, it was a deadly thing pre-war, diphtheria.
When he tells you Indian airborne, he wasn't jumping out of aeroplanes, he was in gliders. He wasn't not coming down by parachute. They were going in silently in gliders.
It's not much fun because as soon as the glider, the tow rope is released from the glider, it goes down. But it feels as if it's going up.
No,
it's incredible.
Yeah.
However,
you were doing practice.
We did quite a lot because I was with the section, Royal Signals section, attached to a Royal Artillery Regiment, and our job was keeping the communications going within the regiment, battery to battery, and back to brigade headquarters. So we did quite a bit of that. Bit of practice, exercise. Oh, well, I've got so many things to talk about. And then when I came out of the hospital at Bilaspur, I was sent back down to Secunderabad, which was where the division was formed, and I've been there when it was formed, convalescent. And one of the things that we did, we were offered a day out to Hyderabad on the Deccan, and that's where we were told there was Hindu-Muslim antagonism. And I don't know whether you know, but they found bombs there the other day. Amazing city, Hyderabad. City walls wide enough to drive several buses abreast along them. And the gates to the city, you know, it takes several seconds to get the truck in. Lovely. So that's why India grows on you. You've seen history going back year after year. Well, decade. No, it's really old. And then the next place I went was Karachi. Lovely food. There was a feeling, and I don't know whether it's right, but there was a feeling that the food improved because the army was anxious to persuade people to sign on for regular service. I don't know, but it's possible. And then one night we awoken in Karachi. I could hear drums thudding. Actually, it was Rajputana Rifles having a ceremony. And the rumour got around as we stood there, Indian Navy has mutinied. But it's not quite true. It was simply that at Bombay was a frigate or corvette or something called the Hindustan, and it was officered by possibly European or, you know, Indian officers, but the bulk of the crew were men from the south of India. They were anxious to join in with Gandhi, and if they captured the Hindustan, they could say, "We've got Hindustan, we've got India." So they mutinied, and they docked at Karachi docks and chucked the officers off, and word got around, and our regiment was called out because the Hindustan had guns, you see. Actually, they couldn't depress them enough to fight our guns. They could only fire at the angle that any warship can fire at. So we had to open fire on them. I've got a book of memories, and one of them is some chap called John Marshall, and he was in charge of one of the batteries that opened fire and killed about a dozen Indian sailors. The whole thing, I think, was kept fairly quiet. I believe we did the right thing, because if you get a mutiny, you've got to put it down, haven't you? It's just a shame that it happened to the people who were mutinying were nationalists. It was their country they were siding with. And then where? Let's test his knowledge. Where is Quetta? It's quite a nice place. Hello. It's in Balochistan. It's on the Balochistan-Afghanistan border. It's all huge mountains all around. And there was an earthquake there in 1935. And nowadays, and here's the lesson, when the city was flattened virtually, it was forbidden to rebuild it unless the roads were very wide and single storey. So that was done. Nowadays, it's surrounded by flats. See? Money, business, and take precedence over safety. It was quite nice in Quetta, though. Quite a nice place.
Did you have much contact with the Indian population to be able to determine their attitude towards the British presence?
Unfortunately, no. It was customary for the army to live in cantonments, as it's spelt, but in fact pronounced cantonments. So you were almost a village within an area. You had your own little market, your own cinema. You were living apart from the rest of the Indians. You could form bonds with the people who ran the canteen or who came around selling things, especially charwallas. They're the people you bonded with. And even the bearers who cleaned your boots in the barrack room, or the nappy wallers. Nappy not being a, you know,
a nappy,
but he's the barber. And you paid a few rupees a week, and he would shave you every day. You could even be in bed half awake, and he'd be lathering your face. They were the people you bonded with. And somewhere in those photographs, I've got one of the charwallers, a photograph of him squatting with his tin box full of buns and his charcoal burner heating the tea jar. And I actually got his name, and I actually got him to sign it. So they were not all illiterate. They were, some of them, very good blokes. But I could kick myself for not bonding more with the Indians. But it was considered that if you did that too much, you'd become native. So you didn't mean a bond with the local population. A pity.
What about language learning?
I cannot remember any textbook at all on Indian, Hindustani, because it's called Hindi now. But there's all sorts of Urdu, Hindi, Telugu, Pushto. Don't say Pulto. No, we used mainly simple English with a few Hindustani words in that everybody understood. And the strange thing is that although nowadays we say OK, which stands for what? Who invented OK? Is it a Comanche word or a Kiowa? Or is it from some general in the American army who used to say all correct, and he used to spell it O-R-L-K-O-R-R? Anyway, the equivalent is TKI. It's amazing, isn't it? There is a connection between the... It means, you know, good is good, TKI. The other thing I've never forgotten is Salaam Alaikum. Peace be to... When an occupational therapist came to see me, he'd been born in India, and I used that expression, and he was quite chuffed, you know. Although he spoke English with a Canadian accent. So,
You mentioned the different religious backgrounds of the, the Indians in your unit. How did they all relate with each other?
I don't really know. We did not have what we would have today. We did not have the intermingling of the different units within a division. So we didn't really get to know them. I can remember clearly an Indian signals dispatch rider coming up one day. I forget where it was, and somebody offered him a cigarette, and the Sikhs are absolutely opposed to cigarette smoking. So that was a bit of an embarrassing thing. I'm not sure whether I shouted my head off and told this bloke who offered the cigarette that he was a fool. Oh, I haven't got that. I haven't forgotten that, but I'm busy talking to this bloke from the... Yes. I learned a bit from reading on bits about the Sikhs, and they won't shave, and you don't want a lecture, don't you? But they have to. We always wear a special armband and a comb in their hair and special underpants. And I don't go along with that, because I like a religion to be simple.
How many cigarettes have you smoked?
God knows. All right, do I speak the Indian language? Ek, do, teen, char, punch, sat, art. I've got 8 left. Oh. No, it's languages and etymology, very interesting things. You know, you get a sort of...
How did you find the climate?
The monsoon was a bloody nuisance, but there is something that I learned, and that is to, during a monsoon, you strip off apart from your footwear, because you don't want to tread on something, and stand in the rain stark naked, and all the things like sweat rash and prickly heat, they tend to get cleared up, because the water coming down is almost uncontaminated. The weather can be a nuisance, but the army had realised that, and in most units, most of the time, there was nothing to do in the afternoon. You did an early morning parade. You did what had to be done in the morning, lunch or tiffin, as we call it. And then the afternoon, virtually nothing. Sometimes an evening parade, it depended. But most of it was spent on your bed, laying down, drinking. You'd have on the veranda of every hut, would be a thing called a chutty, which was full of water, but it was earthenware, so it was the water was slightly leaking out, and of course as it evaporated, what does evaporation cause? Coolness. It cooled the water, yeah. So you got cool water out on the veranda. Sleeping at night under a mosquito net was not always fun. You're isolated. And on the odd occasion, a mosquito might have got inside the net before you got in. Oh, that was... And you could sleep naked, but you had to have something to cover your belly in case No, they started sweating too much and you got a chill.